Joint House and Senate Finance Committee will please come to order. It is Monday, September 26, 1994. Second special session of the second session of the 18th Alaska Legislature. It's 4 p.m. and we are here today to hear Senate Bill 382 and Senate Bill 383 along with House Bill 549 and House Bill 550. Ladies and gentlemen, we are on teleconference, so please speak clearly. First, here from the Senate Finance Committee today are myself, Senator Pierce, Senator Jacko, Senator Kelly, Senator Curtula, Senator Sharp, Senator Rieger, and my co-chair, Senator Frank. We also have in the room Senator Phillips, Senator Salo, and Senator Lehman. We have the House co-chair, Representative Ron Larson, who will introduce House members that we've managed to keep track of.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. From the Finance Committee, we have with us today from the House, Representative Ben Gusendorf, Representative Sean Parnell, Representative Kay Brown, Vice Chairman, Representative Mark Hanley, and Representative Terry Miller. Terry Martin. You got me confused with a three-piece suit on today, so I'm hating myself. So my apologies, Representative Martin. Also, we're going to have to ask him to join us at the table here. We have Representative Richard Foster from the Finance Committee, who is comfortable where he's sitting. And we have Representatives Jeanette James, Representatives Bill Hudson, Representative Ed Willis, and Representative Pete Cott. I also see Representative Gary Davis and Representative John Davies. And have I missed anyone?
Just a Jerry.
Oh, Representative Jerry Saunders. Here he is over on this side. We will try to keep everyone abreast as my co-chair, Representative McLean, comes in, along with any other members of the House that may be joining us. And I also want to call everyone's attention to the fact that we have a limited number of packets here, so when we break up into our separate Finance Committee meetings, this legislation, take your packet along with you.
Thank you. It is our intention to first take testimony from the administration. These two bills are governor's bills. We will hear testimony about both bills at the same time. We will then go to those people who have signed up to testify. At the moment, I have Mr. David Walker and Mr. Jim Gottstein. There is a sign-up sheet at the back should others wish to sign up. So with that, I believe for the administration, we have the Attorney General, the Commissioner of Natural Resources, and is Mr. Stastny going to join you at the table?
Yes, Madam Chairman.
And Mr. Stastny. If the three of you would please identify yourselves for the record. If at all possible, I'd like to hold and ask questions after the gentlemen have had an opportunity to give their overview. But if any of you have an absolute burning question while they're talking, if you'll just raise your hand for me, I will call on you. And with that, gentlemen.
For the record, I'm Commissioner Noah, and I have a heck of a cold, so bear with me today. What we'd like to do is to give you an overview of these two bills. What we'd like to do first is have the Attorney General go through point by point of the judge's decision, our recent decision on preliminary approval. Shelby is going to go through basically the money aspects of this bill and where the dollars are coming from. I will briefly discuss for you the land package associated with the bill, and then Tom Custer will come up and go through the specifics of each bill for you today.
I could interrupt just 1 second. I want to acknowledge other members of the Finance Committee, Representative Mike Navarre, and my co-chair, Representative Eileen McLean. And did anyone else come in since?
Gene Terrio.
And also Representative Fran Ulmer and Representative Gene Terrio, a member of the Finance Committee.
And Jim Nordland just walked in.
And Representative Nordland has joined us. So pretty soon we'll have a full constituency group.
Madam Chairman, maybe just a comment as we start. You're going to hear comments for approving this bill. You're going to hear comments against it today. You will hear people with different motives trying to possibly tear apart the deal. But as far as we're concerned, once you all make your decision today, there's really only one person that has to approve the settlement at this point, and that's Judge Green. She was kind enough to lay out in a very detailed order, a 56-page order that the Attorney General will go through, her specific concerns. And the bills that we have in front of you today address those specific concerns. And with that, I hope that we can move along as quickly as we can, and I will turn it over to the Attorney General.
Madam Chairman, Mr. Chairman, my name is Bruce Patello, Attorney General for the state. Like Commissioner Noah, I too suffer from some sore throat. We've been doing a lot of talking the last couple weeks, and I think we've probably strained our resources to the utmost. By way of background, the mental health settlement which was reached was largely embodied in the legislation passed in your first special session this year, and it embodied basically five elements. Just to briefly recap, they include the reconstitution of the land trust itself, 930,000 acres. It included a cash component of $200 million. It established a trust authority. It incorporated certain benefits that had been set forth in Chapter 66 that we have denominated generally as programmatic improvements. And the fifth element was a modified budget process, which has the consequence of isolating, as it were, your evaluation of mental health programs in the budgetary process. All of this was embodied in a settlement which we reached with the parties and presented, not all parties obviously, and which was presented to Judge Green, the Superior Court judge, asking for her preliminary approval. Now, as you know, the mental health lawsuit has been a class action almost since inception. It was certified within about 3 months of the filing of the initial case in late 1982. And so when a settlement is presented in the context of a class action, there's a four-part process that the courts must go through before it can be finally approved. And that first step is called the preliminary approval. The court makes a preliminary determination about the fairness of the deal. Is it sufficient to allow it to proceed to the next step? And that next step is the giving of notice to all class members. The third step is a fairness hearing. And the final step is final approval. Where are we today? Let me just briefly summarize. Notice has been sent to some 270,000 households in the state. There's been notice additionally to 1,400 care providers. There has been publication in numerous newspapers throughout the state advising members of the public of their right to submit written comment on the terms of the proposed settlement by October 21st. And those comments go directly to Judge Green. The third step, and what we're working towards now, is the fairness hearing. Judge Green has scheduled 2 weeks of hearings, the first to be held in Anchorage beginning the week of October 21st, and the second to continue in Fairbanks beginning on October 31st for that week. Judge Green has indicated her intent to issue her final ruling by November 15th. Judge Green granted preliminary approval on July 29th. And it is the first time, the only time, that any settlement on this topic has reached the stage of preliminary approval. As you recall, in late December of last year, in fact, she refused to grant preliminary approval on the terms of the previous settlement, which the administration had reached with the assistance of legislative action. She issued a 58-page decision, which in her analysis, she began by asking four questions. And those are what I'd like to review with you briefly because it explains why we're gathered here today. The first question that she posed was, is the proposed settlement the product of serious, informed, non-collusive negotiations? Second, is the proposed settlement without serious deficiencies? The third question, is the proposed settlement without preferential treatment of segments of the class? And finally, does the settlement fall within the range of possible approval? Let me go through the answers very briefly. She concluded first, and I believe you have copies of the actual decision, so let me refer you to the pages to the extent that this may be of some assistance. First of all, she concluded that the proposal was serious, product of serious negotiation, page 27. She found that it was informed, page 29, and that it was non-collusive at page 32. She was presented with some 7 purported deficiencies that should lead to the conclusion by those who opposed the proposed settlement. She concluded that the proposed settlement does not have any serious deficiencies. But let me review very briefly what the deficiencies that were alleged. She expressed the view that the possible termination by appeal, that is our former effective date, or the current effective date, was not sufficient to warrant denial of preliminary approval. It's at page 32. Second, that the proposed settlement is enforceable. If the legislature changes a material term, a subsequent legislature, the class is free to reassert all claims which are or were available on July 29th. That's found at page 33. She concluded, contrary to the assertions of those opposing the settlement, that the terms were not unclear, page 37. She concluded that the lack of a legal description for each of the parcels is not a problem, page 38. She concluded that there was no competent evidence that the Department of Natural Resources was or is unable perform its obligations to convey land to the trust authority. That's at page 38. He concluded that the land management requirements in HB 201 cannot, and in fact do not, diminish the trust responsibilities found in the Federal Enabling Act. She concluded, and that will be found at page 40, management by the Department of Natural Resources is not a serious deficiency, again found at page 41. Those were the 7 specific objections, again raised by those opposing the settlement. Again, the second question, or the third question, is the proposed settlement without preferential treatment of segments of the class? And she concluded that there is no improper preferential treatment of segments of the class. And the final question that she had before her was whether it falls within the range of possible approval. And she had several remarks to be made there. Her standard was that in evaluating fairness, the most important element is a comparison with the likely results of litigation, page 44. Again, she identified at some length what she saw are the specific benefits provided the beneficiaries in the settlement, the reconstitution of the trust with the land, the cash settlement, the trust authority, the budget process advantages, and those other advantages in Chapter 66. She concluded that while the, and in her words, the litigation results are, of course, unknown, however, it is very clear that program improvements, the trust authority, and budget process advantages could not be obtained through litigation. And she went on to state that it is entirely possible, if not likely, that there would be no cash component from continued litigation. She noted that a trial would be extremely expensive, lengthy, and complex. She concluded that the plaintiffs, all plaintiffs, had sufficient information to adequately evaluate the proposal and reached the following conclusion. Based on this preliminary examination, the court concludes that this settlement is within the range of possible final approval at pages 57 and 58. If that were all there were to it, there'd be very little reason for all of us to be sitting here. Judge Green did identify three areas of concern. The first area, generally speaking, deals with the lands list, and in that there were two or three specific concerns. The first and most important, the so-called Solche parcel of 116,000 acres, which, as you know, is part of a federal military reservation. It is has been and continues to be used as a bombing range, which still has quite a bit of ordnance on it. The court concluded, and it explains the reason in part for this special session, that if the parties have not found a solution by the time of the final approval hearing, the court and the beneficiaries will be forced to examine the degree of risk posed by the problem and the impact on the settlement if no solution is found. Failure to find a solution to the problem associated with the Solche property could lead to non-approval. Judge Green also identified with regard to the land list that there were miscellaneous problems that were discovered after the legislature adjourned in May. And again, that brings us partly to this call. The second area of concern that Judge Green identified as problematic was the possible shortfall in the funding sources for the $200 million cash component, and in particular the $25 million identified as part of the DNR portfolio, land sale contract portfolio. Concern the testimony presented was that it was quite likely that there might be a shortfall, so that rather than $25 million, we would be talking in the range of $16 to $19 million. And the court again noted this, in her words, the possible unavailability of the $25 million as a problem. If it is not resolved, the court and class members will have to evaluate the agreement in that light. The court does not find the problem to be a deficiency which precludes granting preliminary approval, but it may be an issue for consideration at final approval, at page 37. The final area of concern which the court outlined in her decision was with regard to the termination of the settlement if a party were to file an appeal. As you recall, the benefits of the House Bill 201 was not to take effect until the case is dismissed and all opportunity for appeal has disappeared by December 15th, unless by November 30th the governor has agreed to extend that period of time up to 45 days. Judge Green noted that under these circumstances and under the Alaska court rules, a party could wait till December 15th to even file the appeal, because under Alaska court rules, there is a 30-day filing appeal. Even if the governor were to extend by 45 days, Judge Green noted that there are very few cases in the history of the Alaska Supreme Court where it has ruled within 45 days of an appeal being filed. The court had these final words to offer on that subject. The court agrees that the effect of appeal on the settlement provisions is problematic. In essence, despite the investment of many hours and significant money by everyone in the approval process, any party can destroy the settlement by filing an appeal from a grant of final approval. Nevertheless, the court does not see this as a problem sufficient to warrant denial of preliminary approval. Madam Chairman, in conclusion, in terms of this brief summary, the court, for the first time, has granted preliminary approval. We are on track towards a final resolution. Our purpose in outlining this to you is to highlight specifically the three areas that the court found as problematic and which will weigh heavily in her determination whether or not to ultimately grant final approval. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Attorney General. For the record, both Senator Lincoln and Senator Little have joined us. We also have Representative Hoffman, Representative Williams, Representative Davidson, and Representative Bundy that have come in and joined us in the room. I didn't see any others. Are there questions for the Attorney General before we go on to other discussion? Okay, gentlemen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Shelby Stastny. Pardon me?
The money part.
The money part. My name is Shelby Stastny, Director of the Office of Management and Budget. And as the Attorney General pointed out, one of the difficulties that the judge had had to do with the sale of the portfolio of contracts from the Department of Natural Resources. At the time that the legislature passed this bill, we had a projection that indicated the fair market value of those contracts then was right close to $25 million, and we expected that $25 million is what we were going to be able to get out of the contracts. A couple of things have happened since then. One, interest rates, as you know, have increased significantly, which has had a depressing effect on the value of those contracts. And the other is just the passage of time. These contracts were receiving between $300,000 and $400,000 a month in principal payments on these contracts. From the time that you were here until now, the contracts have that much less principal value, and there wasn't any provision for that money to be used for anything other than to go into the general fund, as it's always done. And so it's not available on the sale of those contracts as we had stated in our appropriation bill. So that's the bad news. The good news is that there's more money in the mental health trust income account than we anticipated that there would be because of the change in oil prices, mainly. And then the other thing that has occurred is the mental health trust income account. When we did our calculations, and as a matter of fact, when you passed your appropriation bills, we expected the mental health trust income account was going to be in existence until June of 1995, and that's when we measured the $33 million that we put in here. Well, as a matter of fact, when the bill was passed, the mental health bills were passed, the mental health trust income account went away, if you will, upon passage of that act, which was in June of 1994. And so what we did was looked at what the balance was then at the end of June of 94 rather than the end of June of 95 to find out how much was available to fund this $200 million, and as a matter of fact, there's $47.7 million in the mental health trust income account at the end of June of 1994. And the other unknown, if you will, or the other estimate, if you will, in the appropriation bill that we passed was the income, the mental health trust income that remains in the general fund that's accounted for by Department of Natural Resources. We assumed that there was going to be $11.7 million in that account, and as a matter of fact, today it's close to $13 million in that account, so there's a little bit more there than we thought there would be. So what we've tried to do then, and we think that it's done without really any new money because the accounts are all there and there's really more money in those accounts than $200 million that we had planned on, and the legislation that we've proposed gives us some opportunity to recognize that there's more money in one account than the other account, and rather than using a definitive dollar amount, has some backstop measures so that we don't have to come back and again make sure we've got exactly $200 million in there. We've drafted legislation that allows us to use backstop measures to make sure that the money's there and everything gets funded, and what's left then, which there will be some left, as you can see. When I say you can see, I did send a member letter to all members of the legislature that showed the numbers. And as that letter pointed out, it looks like there's going to be about $7 to $10 million in these identified accounts, more than $200 million, which will then lapse to the general fund.
Are there specific questions for Mr. Stasny? Senator Kelly and then Senator Frank. Senator Frank.
A couple questions. Who brought this deficiency to the attention of the court? You know, was it the opposing attorneys or the supporting attorneys or you guys or whatever? When did you decide, or maybe you had always had in your mind that you would sell the portfolio to raise cash? I'm wondering about whether those land sales contracts are more valuable in the trust rather than selling them and getting cash for them and then reinvesting them at some perhaps lower rate or something. I don't know.
Madam Chair, we brought it, actually my staff brought it to my attention early on that we might have a shortfall in the portfolio. And we started to look at what our alternatives were. It was brought up again during the first hearing in Judge Green's court, and we were asked a number of questions then about it. And this is just an outcome of that concern, trying to deal with the shortfall. In terms of whether it would be more valuable in the trust account, there certainly, over a longer period of time, there would be more money that would go into the trust. But we have a $200 million number that we're trying to reach, and it's a number versus now versus over time type of a thing. And the agreement that we've reached is money now in terms of.
So it was always the intention to sell the portfolio to generate cash, to give the trust cash versus
an
income-producing asset.
That's correct.
For the record, Senator Duncan has joined us, along with both Representatives Finkelstein and Carney, whose plane made it in this morning. Senator Kelly.
Shelby, was any mention made by Judge Green on the inflation-proofing language on Section 8, page 3, Senate Bill 383?
I'll defer to these gentlemen. I wasn't there.
She made no reference in her written decision.
I'm just wondering where the inflation-proofing language came in. It seems to me that we had discussed that issue in regular session, that we had decided not to inflation. We questioned whether or not to inflation-proof this fund. We were told that the people speaking for the mental health community didn't want to inflation-proof the fund, and so we backed off of doing that. I'm wondering, I understand the $200 million concept. Why are we now expected to pay for inflation-proofing above and beyond the $200 million, and when does that stop, and could that be some kind of a constant drain?
As I remember, that was actually, as I remember, I thought that went in as part of the final amendments in the bill, the inflation-proofing, as I remember. That was put in on...
I didn't see it as language. Is it in the bill?
I thought it was the subcommittee of you and Rieger that required that.
Senator Rieger.
Madam Chairman, I remember reading it somewhere in the materials that I was reading through before coming down here, and I believe it is in the bill that was passed. But as I recall, and you can correct me, inflation proofing is a permissible use of trust income, and what some of the discussions that were going around the Senate at the very end circled on, as I recall, was whether to mandate that or whether it would only remain as a permissible use. And I believe that the mandate did not make it into the legislation. It's only referenced as a permissible use of trust income.
Madam Chairman, that's correct. It's at the discretion of the trust authority.
So why are then we now being asked to increase the $200 million by inflation proofing, and where is the cutoff point where we no longer have to inflation proof?
I don't know the answer.
Yeah, I'm not sure that we are asking that this be inflation proofed over $200 million. I'm certainly not clear that that's the intent of the legislation.
Okay, well, then maybe I'm confused. Senate Bill 383, page 3, line 21, section 8.
Section 10 explains that.
Senator Kelly. Madam Chair, my name is Tom Custer. I'm an attorney in private practice working with the administration and on the proposed settlement. Your question relates to page 3, line 23.
Mm-hmm. Lines 21 through 24, actually. Section 8, subsection A, where it speaks to inflation proofing.
The trust revenue that comes in can be used by the trust authority for a variety of purposes. And one of the purposes under the bill that was passed in the special session is to inflation-proof the principal of the trust fund. It is, as Senator Rieger described it, permissive and not mandatory. In the event, one of the things that the bills are doing is changing the effective date provisions to provide that upon dismissal by the Superior Court, the settlement goes into effect on December 16th. What that does is it takes away the power of a party to prevent the settlement from taking effect by filing an appeal. But to guard the public and to ensure that if the beneficiaries receive the benefits of the settlement, that the public receives those benefits too. Or in the alternative, if on appeal the appellate court reverses the dismissal and we're back in the litigation, then the benefits are repealed. That's when this provision comes into effect. So if the settlement goes into effect and then is subsequently reversed on appeal, this provision has a contingent effective date, goes into effect at that point, takes the money, the $200 million that goes into the mental health trust fund, pulls it out of that trust fund, puts it into the general fund, along with whatever money the trust authority has added to that fund to inflation-proof it in its discretion. So it backs it out so that all parties are back where they are today.
Did you get that, Tim?
Does the inflation proofing then come out of the mental health trust account as opposed to the general fund?
That's correct.
Yes.
It comes out of the income to the trust, and it's discretionary with the trust authority whether to inflation proof or not.
And so we're not, in effect, taking more than $200 million with this whole package. There is no continued drain on the general fund.
That's correct.
Senator Frank?
Can I respond to that a little? It would seem to me that the money that is going to be generated is never going to be sufficient to pay the total amount of the mental health need. So if the money that is generated, if some of it is diverted to pay the inflation proofing, that could mean an additional amount then would be needed from the general fund to subsidize mental health programs. Is that not correct?
It becomes a discretionary judgment call on the part of both the trust authority and on the part of the legislature annually. For the trust authority, the decision is how much of the trust revenue should go to inflation proofing, if any, the balance of the income then going to mental health programs. Annually, the legislature, too, will be determining in its discretion how much money should come from the general fund to go to mental health programs.
That's the clarification I was seeking.
Senator Curtula, did you have a question?
I'd like to play this one out and go back to the lands question. So if there's more questions on this, I'd like to come back to the lands question.
Senator Phillips and then Senator Frank?
Not on that.
But what about on this question? Or?
No, a different question.
Okay, Senator Frank.
So just to be clear, that if the trust authority chooses to not inflation proof and makes no appropriation, if it spends no money to inflation proof, then in the event that the thing is reversed in years to come or at some future date, then there would be no requirement to appropriate an amount in excess of $200 million.
That's correct.
Other questions on this point? Okay, then let's go back to Senator Curtula.
Thank you, Chairperson. Back to the proceeds from sale of the Department of Natural Resources lands. Testimony, unless I misunderstood it, was that only cash, only dollars are acceptable, at least within this legislation. But is that true? The mental health trustees, the people will be responsible subsequently, don't wish assets that are interest-producing. They wish cash, or Judge Green wishes cash, or that's what we've spoke about only. Where are we here?
In term, Madam Chair, In terms of the cash part of the settlement, it was cash. Certainly there are assets that go along with the land portfolio that goes with the, into the trust. But in terms of the cash settlement, it was $200 million.
Now, the next question I have, and I'm somewhat critical of selling DNR assets at discount. It gives you a more balanced portfolio, et cetera. Now, sale, at what stage, let's say that, this is something I'd like to know very much. We've stated that the value of the asset has diminished because of higher rates of interest and less demand and so on. But at what stage of reduction would it no longer be a factor here? Would you no longer sell it? You can't save $10 million or $15 million, 50% of value you're not going to sell. Are you guaranteed this figure now for what, $40 million worth of land or $50 million worth of land or $37 million worth? I can't remember what it was.
Well, actually, the face value of the land is $15 million plus the interest.
Okay.
And what we are envisioning that it will be somewhat greater, between $16 and $19 million. But what's happening every month, we are collecting $300,000
sure.
to $500,000. And that's part of why it's going down, too. I mean, each month we're collecting.
So you don't
money.
Feel called upon to sell it at $5 million, right?
No.
That's the point. And it is something that's relatively fair and equitable for the state that this portfolio would be disposed at or would not be disposed at all. Is that right?
We do not to intend to sell this at a loss.
Thank you. For the record, we've also been joined by Senator Halford and Representative Bryce. Senator Phillips?
Questions to Shelby Stastny. On this bill itself, the state is $33 million for mental health income, but it said they were actually $47.7 million. But my question is more of a technical substantive. Is this going to change later in our draft? Just to show you.
Senator Phillips, could you please repeat your question? I'm sorry, but we can't hear you.
Well, what I was trying to get at is, we have $33 million right here. The actual count was 47.7. And my question is more of a technical than a substantive. Should 47.7 be in the bill, or are we just making sense
Mr. Stastny?
Madam Chair, Senator Phillips. The language that follows basically says that we're not going to change those numbers because they're going to change on a daily basis, and that's why when you get down to section 4 and section 5, it basically says any shortfall in one account is going to be taken care of by the excesses in the other account, because we figured we could never get to a time that we could tie that number down, and then whatever's left out of these four accounts will then lapse, stay in the mental health trust income account until it lapses to the general fund when that account is done away with.
Go ahead, Senator Phillips, if you have a follow-up.
In the bill we passed prior to in regular session, did you get that?
No, we did not.
And that's why we were here.
Right. Representative Brown.
Thank you. With respect to, this is to Mr. Botello, with respect to the issue of enforceability, and you mentioned that all claims which were available on July 29th of this year could be reasserted, what claims would those be exactly that were open for assertion on July 29th?
Virtually all the claims that have been asserted in the class action itself, that have not otherwise been ruled on adverse to the plaintiffs in the case.
So in the future, then, if the legislature made a breach of this agreement, repealed some significant part of it, or did not follow through on our obligations to it, would the effect be that the plaintiffs could go back and go after the entire original 1 million acres, or are some of those acres forever removed from the trust, or the possibility of once again becoming entangled in litigation?
Judge Green has actually stated at three different points. It doesn't directly answer the question on any specific claim, but at page 33,
Her decision provides at about line 8, if the legislative change was material, the class would be entitled to invoke the remedy found in Article 6, Section 5. They would be free to file a new action asserting all the claims they have today. And there's a footnote. The court ensured at oral argument that it was the state's intent that if there were a material change, the class would have all claims they have today and would be free to assert them. And then there's another provision later on where she makes again reference to the ability of the parties or a party in the event that the legislature were to make a material change would be free to assert all claims existing on July 29th.
So on July 29th, did the plaintiffs have the right to go after original trust lands not within the trust proposed in this settlement?
I guess I'm not in a position to exactly define what those claims are. I think the point is that the judge has said whatever they are on July 29th, those are the rights that they are able to assert. Now, whether it includes, and I think one example specifically over which there could be a disagreement would be assuming that the lease pendants is lifted and the moms and pops are freed. Would the plaintiff class or a class of plaintiffs in the event of a future breach by the legislature be able to go against those moms and pops? Probably not. So to that extent, to get a remedy directly against that land, probably not. Would they be able to assert a claim with regard to the underlying question, which is reconstitution? Yes, they would. And the issue has been one that I think has been the subject of great debate in the first place, and that is under the terms of the Supreme Court's decision in 1985, what constitutes a sale? And that's one that has not ultimately been resolved in the litigation up to date anyway.
Can I continue? Representative Navarre. Other questions? Representative Brown.
Yes, and it might be most efficient, Madam Chair, if we heard from some of the other people who are going to speak and then had the opportunity to ask additional questions. I am generally interested in knowing your review and response to the proposals put forward by Mr. Walker and Gottstein, suggesting certain amendments that they would like to see. Did you have the chance to consider those before we received these draft bills? And what is your thinking about the wisdom of addressing any of these issues that they bring up?
Representative Brown, I think it would, for people, other legislators who haven't had a chance to review those, why don't we allow the plaintiff's attorneys to come forward? I know that they're going to be bringing those up, and then if we have additional questions, we can invite the administration back, if that's all right with you. Mm-hmm. Representative Larson?
Yes, we discussed the procedure on that, and we thought it would be best to allow Mr. Walker and Mr. Gottstein to make their presentation before we ask for any response in regards to their letter.
We suspect that some of the legislators aren't as well prepared as you are. Do you have an additional question?
I do, and this is just, it seems like an ambiguity because of your written materials. It's on in the legislation, the description of what happens upon a reversal on appeal. And then there's the phrase, including a petition for certiorari to the U.S. Supreme Court. And reading that with your description, I was confused as to what you really meant, whether it would actually have to be reversed by the Supreme Court for the settlement terms to no longer be in effect, or just the mere fact of appealing to the Supreme Court would trigger the dissolution of this settlement.
The words are reversed on appeal, and those are the operative words, not the actual taking of an appeal or the taking of or filing a petition for certiorari with the Supreme Court. What it would require is either a reversal by the Alaska Supreme Court or a reversal by the U.S. Supreme Court.
Any additional questions? Commissioner Noah, do you have any additional remarks you'd like to make this time?
Yes, just briefly, Madam Chair, on the land list, there have been two issues that have been brought up on the lands issue. First, in regards to the Salsa parcel, what we have done, and you will see before me here, a set of maps, an addendum to HB 201. It's dated September 23rd, 1994. It outlines the additions and deletions to the land list that was part of the original bill. In terms of the Salsa parcel, there has been an exchange of acreage. The parcel that has been exchanged is in the same general area, although a number of miles away. To obtain the same value, this is a subsurface parcel, to obtain the same value, we had to increase the acreage involved. The original parcel was 118,436 acres. The parcel that will be we have exchanged for is 184,599 acres. The reason for that is the geology associated with this is somewhat different. The original parcel was somewhat more favorable. To obtain the same subsurface value, we had to increase the acreage associated with the parcel. So that addresses one of the first of the judge's concerns. The second was a whole group of miscellaneous errors as part of the land list. Originally, we had over 10,000 parcels that we were essentially changing around three different times. So if you can imagine what that was like moving all those around at that time. We, as part of this final list, there are 247 additions to the land list and 168 deletions. And these mainly had to do with simple miscoding on the parcel numbers. There were a set of parcels that were identified to us that we simply overlooked. We had made an agreement as to a parcel ought to go into the trust, and we simply overlooked those. You have two sheets from us that explain this. First, a memo from Bruce Phelps to me explaining a group of individual parcels, and then one by election district explaining where these individual parcels are. We'll be happy to go into any detail that you may wish to in regards to these particular parcels. But for the most part, they're quite small, with the exception of the Salsa parcel, and are really technical in nature. There is one final addition that I need to read into the record. When Bruce was going over the final list, just to make sure, we found that we had deleted one which should be added, and that is SM-2225-A. It's a hydrocarbon interest only. It's a 50-acre parcel. That will be handwritten into this list and should be added here. I'd be happy to answer any questions related to the land list. Thank you.
Are there questions for the commissioner?
What is the list?
That is, I believe that's the list he held up.
Which one is that? There's two. There's this, by election district, and we haven't given you the actual list because it's just ADL numbers, but we'd be happy to provide a copy of that if you...
Which of our packets are those in?
Yeah.
Department of Natural Resources materials? Yes, it is. It's in the Department of Natural Resources under the blue tab. It's the third staple. Representative Brown.
With respect to the mining claims or other leases that are going into the trust, what will be the obligation of the trust in the future with respect to administration of those? Will the trust have the flexibility to change material terms and conditions of those mining claims or leases or agreements?
The way I addressed that question in court was that those, in my mind, are valid existing rights and need to be dealt with as we dealt with them in the bill as valid existing rights.
So any opportunities that exist in those contracts themselves for changes would be fair for the trust to
propose changes,
or seek changes?
The way that that will be dealt with is in regulation at this point. As you know, we are to come out with a set of regulations. That is something that will take quite a bit of effort on everyone's part at this point. And to prejudge that at this point would be sort of improper on my part. But that will all be dealt with in regulation as this bill moves forward.
Additional questions? For the record, we are online to Anchorage, Fairbanks, Matsu, and Kenai Soldotna. If there are no additional questions, yes, Representative Davis.
I'd like to ask one follow-up question to that last one that has to do with general question with respect to easements of across parcels of land that are being put into the trust now. Do all pre-existing, all presently existing easements follow with those parcels that are being put into the trust? I'm particularly concerned about issues of access across those parcels.
Madam Chairman, again, we have that issue of valid existing rights. If they were a valid existing right beforehand, they would be in a valid existing right after in going into the trust. One of the points that's been made is DNR is in the process of identifying all the encumbrances associated with these different parcels. That would be part of the record then.
Are there others? Other questions? Okay. Would be our intention to take a 5-minute break. When we come back, we'll take Mr. Walker first, then Mr. Gottstein, Mr. Boland, Mr. Jesse, and Mr. Waldo. We do have one person in Anchorage and four in Fairbanks that have asked whether or not we'll take public testimony. I believe I will clarify that when we come back after the break. It would be my intention to continue the teleconference throughout the testimony by the plaintiff's attorneys. We will reconvene at 5 o'clock. It's about 5 till.
Finance Committee's back to order. It is now about 8 minutes after 5. Let me clarify our intent. We will hear from Mr. Walker and Mr. Gottstein. You have, by the way, in front of you a handout that we distributed during the break from them. We will then hear from Mr. Philip Boland and Mr. Jeff Jesse. I misspoke. Tom Waldo is here on behalf of the public interest interveners to respond to questions if there are any. He does not have testimony prepared. As I mentioned, we have people who have requested the opportunity to testify this evening on our teleconference sites. We have four in Fairbanks, one in Anchorage, and one in the Matsu. It would be my intent, ladies and gentlemen, to encourage you to file with us whatever written testimony you have, whatever length it is. We will make it part of the public record. We will make it available not just to the Finance Committee members, but to all members. And it will become part of the full final record of this special session. However, when we do take your testimony tonight, which will be after the plaintiff's attorneys, and after we've had another opportunity to ask the administration any follow-up questions that we have, I would ask each of you to prepare to limit your testimony to 3 minutes. And that I don't know whether there are more people at the locations who may want to testify or not, but we want to make sure that everybody has an opportunity to talk with us here this evening. If there's nothing else, we will go now to Mr. Walker and Mr. Gottstein. If the two of you would both please identify yourselves for the record.
Madam Chairman, Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is David Walker. I represent Vern Weiss, father and next friend of Carl Weiss, and Earl Hilliker, and others similarly situated. They are class representatives in this class action. And to my right, your left, is Mr. Gottstein, who represents the Alaska Mental Health Association, Mary C. Nanowak, and John Martin, and others in this litigation.
Great.
Gentlemen, do you have prepared testimony, please?
Thank you very much. I believe that it's important for us to appear here today and to explain to you why the clients that we represent maintain their opposition to this settlement and to the proposal that is before you. This settlement is not acceptable to the original plaintiffs of the litigation, and there are several reasons for it. I'll try and go through those and be brief. I think it's important for us to be here and answer any questions that you may have so that you can not only predict what we will do, but think about the positions you will be put in during the course of this litigation. One of the principal reasons that this settlement is not acceptable to us is because we truly believe that it is unenforceable. I'll talk in a few moments about what it is that we get and the adequacy of the settlement, but it has always been an essential element of every settlement that's been proposed before the legislature, and there are three of them that we have supported, that enforceability was a watchword here. Moving to that immediately, and I'll go back and talk about some of the other things here, but it seems to me that how you can key on to this is to think about the questions that Representative Brown asked the Attorney General at the close of his testimony, and they were about enforceability and about the ability of the beneficiaries in this litigation to reassert their original claims in the face of a breach by the state. So the question assumes that the settlement agreement has been breached, that some legislature 10 years out from now breaches the settlement, does something to the trust authority, for example. And what claims can be reasserted? I don't believe that the Attorney General's answer was responsive. I don't believe it was direct and responsive to the question, and I'd like to try and answer that. Because it is that the claims that the original plaintiffs have now and the claims that the court, in her opinion, felt were so important were claims to the land that the original trust land that the municipalities now have, that the state has in legislatively designated areas, that the private third-party purchasers that the Attorney General call moms and pops, that's a class of those lands, and the coal lands, which are original trust lands, all of those are claims that were part of this litigation and this lawsuit. And in discussing the enforceability, the court said, in addition to the things that the Attorney General explained, that the fact that the plaintiffs can reinstitute this lawsuit, this litigation, can hang over everybody's head, should be a sufficient deterrent to keep the legislature from breaching this settlement, from doing them in. It should be a sufficient deterrent. Well, to be a deterrent, that enforceability has to be against the original claims. It's no deterrent at all if all the plaintiffs can do is assert that claims against the lands that are on the to-be-conveyed list that are in this settlement, the non-lightning rod lands in this settlement. So I think there's been a real miscommunication with the court, and I believe that in and of itself is going to be enough to be the undoing of that. The question then comes about what claims can we reassert if the question is the claims you have today, and today follows your enactment of House Bill 201, which removes all of the original plaintiff's claim, establishes a set-off at $1.3 billion, and says mean things about the plaintiffs, then we've got nothing. We've got nothing. And I think that's the key. The state is clearly reserving the right in this litigation to assert that House Bill 201 blocks the reassertion of all of the original claims. You should know that when you do it. You should know that the consequence and that we're talking about is the Supreme Court of this state or of the United States saying that this settlement was a bum deal, and because of that, we're making the decision to take away the plaintiff's original claims. We're making the decision to establish this set-off and to say the things that 201 repeats about the plaintiffs. So that's the decision that this legislation makes. I will tell you in absolutely good faith that I believe there is a good chance that the legislation will not be approved that the settlement will not be approved by the Superior Court because of the standard that is different for final approval and preliminary approval.
and I believe that there is a good chance that if it is approved, it will be overturned on appeal. Now, why is it that we maintain this? The elements that we maintain must be fixed here before we would have a settlement that the original plaintiffs to the litigation would support? Well, basically, I mean, there are several things, and all of you have letters that detail what our opposition is and the fixes that we believe would be proper here. But I think the basic nubbin of it is that what this settlement does is take away a trust that, properly managed, has a good chance to fund a mental health program for Alaska, certainly to fund, make a very sufficient funding of the core group of mental health needs. And to take that land away and that trust away and to trade it for a trust which, by its very terms, can't do that and won't do that. I mean, there's no way all of us here at this table recognize that the income that can be produced by this substitute trust will never do that. And that's the nubbin, basically the nubbin of the concern, is of the concern about the adequacy of it. On September 5th, I wrote a letter to you all and said, you need, if you fix certain things, if you do certain things to this settlement, that I would be willing to recommend this settlement to the mental health community and to the clients that I represent. I know that it would not be their preference. I know that this settlement would not be their preference, but like you, I weary of this litigation, and so I would very much like to put it behind me, and I'd like to come with another settlement effort before you. This one fixed this, and my recommendation will be to them that they accept it. And the fixes are that the discrepancy on the land lists, which the administration spoke about and which Mr. Gottstein will speak about, be corrected. Basically, that the problem with the land lists is that in presenting the information to the court about the value of this settlement on an agreed upon, a fixed valuation procedure, if you will, which was essentially, I think, the procedures of the Interim Mental Health Trust Commission, but it was kind of a benchmark, so it could be applied to all properties, substitute and original trust land, and figure out what that was. And listing the categories of land, the representation was that the deal here was about $1.1 billion in land and $200 million in cash. When you add up we didn't have the list at that time. We could not see, because it was the new trust is constituted on this lands to be conveyed. When we actually got the lands to be conveyed list from the state and looked at the parcels, and applied those same valuation procedures to them, it's turned out to be about a $95 million difference between $1.1 billion and the number that, when you add up the constituent part of all of those parcels. So I think that that's something, if the court was concerned about the value difference that the Salsa Exchange may make, the judge will certainly be very concerned about these values. We can certainly answer questions about those, but that's the outline of that issue. The next thing that I mentioned in the letter is that in order for us to support this settlement, the representations that the state made to the court in the preliminary hearing would need to be formalized and made part of the settlement. Some of those changes will require legislation. Some of them could be done in the settlement agreement. And in that hearing, Commissioner Noah testified, for example, the thrust of his testimony was that the trust, this substitute trust, would be managed for the maximum benefit of the beneficiaries. And so, and that's very comforting to me. But that's a commitment that needs to be made for all administrations, ensuing administrations. And so that change will have to be made to the settlement. It was my understanding, in listening to the conversations and presentations between the counsel for the state and the court, that in fact, as an enforceability and deterrent issue, that the plaintiffs would be able to reassert their original claims in the event of a breach by the state. And I felt that the settlement agreement didn't provide that. I thought it was at odds, and I have always felt that it was at odds with that representation. And so I addressed that issue directly. I've addressed that issue directly to counsel for the state. And the state's response is, as the Attorney General has advised you, and that is that the state really reserves the right years on down the road to assert that House Bill 201 cuts off all of the plaintiff's original claims. They have only the claims that they had after 201. The amendments that we provide that fix. So I think the other parts of the things were easy to get a handle on. The easy to get a handle on part of it was that that the coal lands that are original trust lands should remain in the trust. There's absolutely no justification for removing them from the trust. And there needed to be some kind of compromise on questions about surveying so that the property that was transferred to the trust the trust would be able to know what it had and be able to market and manage and develop it. Those amendments have been provided to you, and we can certainly go through those. I look at the bill, I'm struck as a former legislative drafter in looking at this bill to tell you that that's the Senate version that I'm looking at is House Bill 382. And that I have a great difficulty in understanding portions of it, too. I'm not entirely sure what it does. I'm sure it's very substantive and important, or we wouldn't all be here. But it's troublesome to me that it's not easier for me to understand what it purports to do. In closing my remarks, I just want to tell you that the provisions of 201 that I've said are mean and vindictive, and I think that if you look at them, you will certainly conclude that there's a chance that most of the world would view them that way, will not give you finality in this. This is not a way to get finality. While it is true that the court ultimately is the one that has to be satisfied, there won't be a settlement in this litigation without the original plaintiffs being part of it. It's a myth, an absolute myth, that there is no widespread opposition to this settlement. One part of the package that was distributed to you was a group of resolutions from deeply involved organizations and associations, from the Alaska Alliance for the Mentally Ill, from the Anchorage Alliance for the Mentally Ill, from the Fairbanks Alliance for the Mentally Ill, a resolution of the Alaska Mental Health Association, of Anchorage Residences for Mentally Ill, from the Kenai Alliance for the Mentally Ill, the Kodiak Alliance for the Mentally Ill, Mental Health Consumers of Alaska, and the Rail Belt Alliance for the Mentally Ill. And these resolutions, which I hope that you will take the opportunity to look through, voice great concern with this settlement and opposition to this proposal. I would ask that you remember next year when you're dealing with this again what you've been told by the administration about this. Hold them to the mark. That concludes my remarks.
Thank you. Questions directly for Mr. Walker, or shall we go to Mr. Gottstein and then Mr. Gottstein?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair. What I would like to do is walk through very briefly, unless you would like more detail, the proposed amendments that we have distributed to everyone. There's, I think, a September 21st letter to the respective Speaker of the House and President of the Senate, enclosing a September 20th letter to Julian Mason, who has been the state's outside lead counsel in this matter, and authorized to negotiate on behalf of the state.
Can you wait just a moment and let us make sure that that letter is in our packets? I don't think that it is. I have mine.
It was separately distributed to everybody. I've got extra copies here. Is it in there? If anybody needs extra...
It was where, Representative Brown? Yes. It was in your mail. Okay. Mr. Gottstein, please proceed.
Okay. So I think we should turn to the September 20th letter. and there are three numbered paragraphs. And of course, the opening paragraph says that if these amendments are adopted, we, David and I, will recommend them to our clients for approval without further change. So basically, what we're telling you is that if these amendments are adopted, you have a settlement. And if they're not adopted, then basically you're rolling the dice on whether or not you have a settlement. There won't be a settlement for some time, and I think the elimination of the appeal deadline is a recognition that this will continue for some time. We're not just going to lie down and let this happen. In some ways, I'm struck by a number of things. I've been dealing with this situation since 1978, when the original legislation purporting to abolish the trust was enacted, and I was with the Mental Health Association at that time, and from that period of time until 1982, we tried to get the legislature to fix it at that time, which of course would have been much easier to solve. In 82, we were told, we don't care if it's illegal, sue us. And so we did. And since that time, you've heard the various administrations say, just pass this, and you'll be done with it. And I don't know, I think they were up to about four or five times of that. And as Mr. Walker said, I think that until you get the original plaintiffs who brought this suit to agree that it's a fair settlement, you may be able to jam it through the court, but you certainly don't have a settlement now. What you have now is a settlement that was negotiated with interveners into the lawsuit, not with the original plaintiffs. Okay, I'd like to talk about the land list first. I think you all have, and I've got a few more copies, two pieces of paper that we handed out. One is a spreedsheet with two numbers, 86 million and 94.8 million. And the other one is, down at the bottom, there's a sticker that says Document States Exhibit A, used as Exhibit Preliminary Approval Hearing, House Bill 201, date July 1994. And I'd like to talk, this won't take long, just a couple minutes to describe the incredibly shrinking trust that we've experienced. If you look, for example, on this Exhibit A, what this was is the state presented this at the hearing as our, the plaintiff's valuation of the settlement. So each one of those lines, third-party purchases, oil and gas estate only, long-term leases, etc., were derived from a list of parcels. And we had assigned values to each parcels, and you add up the values for each parcel, and you get the numbers on the right-hand side. If you go 11 lines down, for example, there's a line that says Undisputed Myrtles, and Myrtles was the acronym that we used during Chapter 66 that stands for Mandatorily Reconstituted Trust Lands. And what those are lands that under Chapter 66, everyone agreed would go into the trust. And in fact, they were, as we developed various different lists during the negotiations, those are the ones still that there was never any controversy over, at least in terms of category. And so basically, we had a list that everyone agreed to that had a list of parcels on it that when you added up the values that we assigned to it was $495.5 million. Well, when it turns out, when you compare that list to the list that was actually on the state's April 28th list, it was some $26 million off. Now, $26 million less. $26 million worth of parcels were pulled off that list. Now, that's the first line here, and it might be a little confusing because the middle column said missing parcel value as of September 8th. And what we've been trying to do is keep up with, you know, the kind of almost daily or weekly changes that have been going on with the land list and with the, quote, technical amendments that we saw as of September 8th. The total value of the missing land parcels is $86.4 million. Okay. Then when last week we got the actual proposed addenda to the legislation, we find, lo and behold, that another $8 million worth of land in total has been pulled off the list. Okay. Well, we think that this may be a problem for the court. The court seemed very concerned that the parties get the benefit of the bargain. If you look down at the fourth line from the bottom, the new mineral estate only areas, that's about $80 million of value is assigned to that. That includes Salcha and the Haines area, and I think both of those were valued at about 40. And you've come here to solve a $40 million problem, and the administration basically has been ignoring a $95 million problem. And actually, I think that it's bigger than that. We haven't had a chance to evaluate all of the problems with the land list. Another problem that exists is that the state took some parcels and made them smaller and called them the same number. And so there's obviously not as much value in the smaller parcel as in the larger parcel, but it's pretty hard to track that because the numbers are the same. It'll take a little bit more research. So it's our proposal. What we're saying is that the deal that was struck, if we're gonna support it, the deal that was struck in late April on what was gonna go into the trust should be honored, and that the list that we provided the state earlier this month, of those missing parcels should be added back in, or in lots of cases should not be removed from the trust. The next paragraph, that number paragraph 2, is proposed amendments, and I'd like to turn to the attachments to the letter. What you've got here are essentially three documents in one. The first one is a marked up or redlined version of our proposed amendments to both the statute and to the settlement agreement. If you look at A, for example, the heading A, HB 201 section 9A2, right after that, there's something that looks like a footnote sign. And if you look to the back of that document, the next document is a little screwed up where it's got page 1 and then page 1 struck through. You'll see that same sign. It's kind of like a footnote. But those are explanations of each of those amendments. I'd like to talk about these maybe in terms of order of importance rather than numerical. They're put out in the same order that they go through the bill. But if we talk about Amendment B first, the current legislation provides that the trust authority is to, quote, administer the mental health trust income account, end quote. Okay. The settlement agreement says that the trust authority has the right to spend that money free of any further legislative appropriation. Okay, now there is a very serious constitutional question whether or not that's constitutional, and of course we can't address that here. It is either constitutional or it isn't constitutional, and as I said, there are grave questions about that. The Department of Law has previously opined that it was unconstitutional. But the purpose of this is to make clear that it was the legislature's intent that the trust authority be permitted to spend the money with free of further legislative appropriation. And that's certainly what the beneficiaries have been told, that that's what this settlement does. And if that is, in fact, the legislature's intent, then this amendment should be adopted. Amendment C is basically addresses this reassertion of claims issue and what it does. And in fact, there's a technical change that needs to be done here in the added sections, and the double underlining is added. Section 41 should be added in there. And basically what this says is if this is approved, the part of HB 201, what we refer to as the cram down, the non-settlement kind of coercive punitive measures would be repealed. And the reason for that is once the settlement is finally approved, then there's no reason to have that offensive language in law, for one thing. And it also removes the state's argument that the original claims cannot be reasserted. So what happens is that the idea here is that if the state materially breaches the terms of the settlement, we go back to where we were before the passage of HB 201, not after. And what the situation is that HB 201 says all these lands are taken out of the trust, and the trust only has this land in it. And what we understand the state to be saying now is that only the lands that the state is now already agreeing is in the trust is what the plaintiffs can reassert, and that we don't think is the deterrent to a legislative breach that the court thought it was. And so this amendment is addressed to that problem. Now, the last amendment to the statute, and so there are only really three, is just a question of survey. I think in your package you have a copy of a letter from the Alaska Alliance Evaluation Committee. Page 4 of that, it states that the trust is receiving the same degree of title that the state had received from the federal government, and the same with survey. That's not true. Under the Mental Health Enabling Act, just as with the Statehood Act and the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, the federal government is going to, before it patents the land, it surveys them, and it tells you what your status of title is. Under this settlement, that's not true. The state is exempted from the survey and platting requirements that the trust authority is going to be bound to after it receives the land. And the trust authority or DNR managing it isn't going to even really be able to tell what land it has with any certainty, nor is it going to be able to tell what the encumbrances are. And for example, in that, I think Representative Davies' question is very apropos. We have been wanting the state to identify the encumbrances that come along with this land, and they would not agree to that. Although it turns out, while they were steadfastly refusing to agree to it, the work plan that they are pursuing actually does identify those encumbrances. And so later on in the amendments to the settlement agreement, we suggest a change in the settlement agreement that would just have the state agree to do what they're already planning to do. With respect to the survey, I think the only thing I'd like to just address briefly, two of the settlement agreement amendments. D there, at the very end of it there, the last paragraph, makes clear that in terms of the survey, we're suggesting that there be a 10-year period of survey and that the trust authority work with DNR to determine the priority of those surveys. So we're not asking that it be done immediately, just that the trust authority end up with land that it knows what it is, that it's receiving. And then settlement agreement amendment E, section 5.6, V6, all that does basically is memorialize and formalize the statements as we understood them of Commissioner Noah at the hearing, that the trust would be managed for the maximum benefit of the trust authority to achieve fair market value, and that the trust authority would be treated as the client of DNR. The other amendments basically just relate to our technical legal amendments relating to the reassertion of claims. The last item that we're asking for is that the original land of the trust that had coal on it, that has coal leases, not be removed from the trust. There's absolutely no reason for that land to be removed from the trust. It was trust land when all those leases were signed. We're not asking that any of the lease terms be changed. In the litigation, by the way, we are challenging the validity of all those leases and believe that particularly active coal mines or mine may be liable for substantial back royalties, but we're not asking for any of that sort of thing in a settlement. All we're asking for is that the trust's original coal lands be retained in the trust. I would respectfully suggest that this isn't really that much to put into this settlement to make a settlement. That if you do these things, that you do have a settlement. And if you don't, we're all rolling the dice on it, and it's certainly going to be some time before anybody knows the outcome. So that's kind of the end of what I had to say. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. We have Representative Larson, then Senator Frank, then Senator Coutu.
Yeah, just, I guess, two questions to Mr. Gottstein. First of all, in the conveyance by the federal government to the territory of Alaska, the 100 million acres of land, now, I can't recollect any appropriations by Congress then that allowed this land to be surveyed. And was this land ever surveyed, and at whose cost, this original 1 million acres?
The Mental Health Enabling Act has a two-part process, technically, in it. It says selective and conveyed. Before the federal government conveys land, it surveys it and then issues a patent. I could get the numbers, but I think about 750,000 acres of it has actually been patented, and most of the rest of it, the 250,000, has been what's called tentatively approved. So most of the land that the trust has right now already has been surveyed, and the rest of it will be surveyed. And what happened under the Statehood Act is that there's a three-part process: selection, tentative approval, and patent. When the land is tentatively approved under the Statehood Act, they kind of draw maps on they draw a line on the map and say, this is tentatively approved, and administration of that land is transferred to the state, and survey and patent will follow. And what happens is that if the state then wants to do something with it, it can on its own money, on its own nickel, survey it and then go forward with it, or it can just wait for the federal government to survey it and patent it. So all of the land that the state receives under the Statehood Act and under the Mental Health Enabling Act will eventually be patented. The problem that we have here is that this settlement takes these surveyed lands and just writes descriptions for it without having surveys. And so in a lot of cases, you're taking surveyed lands and making unsurveyed land out of it, unsurveyed parcels. And that's anybody else in the state. Nobody else in the state can do that. That is illegal. Except in this act, the state exempted itself from complying with the surveying and platting requirements and conveying the land to the trust. And all we're saying is that this land should be surveyed. And it's a matter of basic fairness. This cost should not be shifted to the trust authority, and it creates a lot more problems for the trust authority to deal with it, and it will cost it more in its ability to earn income than it will cost the state to just go ahead and survey it. And again, we are proposing a 10-year schedule to get this.